So what I'll be describing in the main part of this talk is a calculation done by a student of mine. His name is Meindert van der Meulen, and we'll describe in this paper, which is JCAP. It's very much his work. He's a quite remarkable student. I set him on a topic called electric baryogenesis, and after some time, sort of halfway his PhD students, he got disenchanted and wanted to find his own work. And after looking around, he came across this topic, which is fluctuations in the sitter space and the relation to the cosmological background radiation. And so it's very much his work, and I had played only a minor part in this. I think he did a great job, but I think it's also interesting to talk about it because it fits well into this workshop of non-equilibrium quantum fields. So something about the background. It has to do with non-Gaussianities in the CMB that people are keen to find. And there was an influential paper by Maldacena some time ago. And then this used classical physics calculating non-Gaussianities. And also other groups who calculated non-Gaussianities, they always use classical physics, classical approximation, which is believed to be very good. But at one point, not only him, but others, like Boudard, has been calculating a lot of quantum physics in the sitter space for a long time, Boudard and collaboration. But also Weinberg, let me mention this, Stephen Weinberg, two papers he mentioned the question, will there be quantum corrections to these cosmological fluctuations? And then he derived a theorem that you expect that for reasonable interactions, the interactions that we know, that there will be corrections that grow after a wavelength is supposed to be not growing anymore, classically, usually. But there can be fluctuation growing after horizon exit, but not faster than powers of the scale factor. And in that calculation, in these two papers, he used the operator formalism and he studied loops, but he actually never precisely calculated one. He argued he didn't do the momentum integrals, he didn't do the time integrals, except for one example, but I would say a complete job wasn't done, and so that's why it was done in a toy model here, what I'm going to describe. And so the question is what you run into. Weinberg appealed to renormalization. You expect that after renormalization, integrals and the outcome will be dominated by the external momentum scale and not by the loop, by the cutoff scale. And so are quite reasonable. But you can ask yourself, how does it work out in practice? And in a way, for me, at least, I was also breaking new ground because you run into some really strange looking or unpleasant looking oscillating integrals. And so how do you deal with it and how do you pull through? And Meindert actually was able to pull through.
Can I just make a quick comment? There's also a student in Austin who's working on, she was working on this. She did explicit calculations.
Who?
I don't know if she actually published it anywhere else than in her PhD thesis.
Who is that?
Chaicho Saku. We all call her Bua, but I don't know. I mean,
okay.
I don't know how you would find her.
Okay, thank you. So, how do you spell her name?
So, C H A I B C E R K S A K U L. There's a D Z missing after A I.
A D Z?
After the I.
Okay, sorry. Okay, and she did more.
Not quite that, but I can write it up for you. I can send you the reference.
Okay.
Put it on the wiki.
Yeah.
Put it on the wiki as a comment to this.
So there's also work by Sloth in two papers, which he did a similar calculation, also more geared to the background radiation effect, where he claims that there can be large corrections, say, in models of chaotic inflation, and that was quite remarkable. He used the phi to the 4 model and basically did this diagram. We use a phi cube model because it's more complicated. At least we limit ourselves to phi cube interactions. And, it becomes more difficult as well. So much for the background. Then the second point will be this calculation of the classical. Yeah. Why classical approximation? Once you have done the quantum calculation, you want to see how good is a classical approximation. And that bears similarities with other calculations. For instance, this calculation I did some time ago with Gerd Aerts and in real time, that was at finite temperature, but there are some similarities with what is happening here because we use similar formalism that was actually found by Mindert independently. Then there are also is the question of the stochastic approach, which is a Langevin approach to put in the sort of the classical statistics in a consistent way, and that started with Langevin, or stochastic as it's called by Starobinsky. And there is a nice summary of that work. Woodard in 2005, and Woodard and Samus, they derived the Langevin approach, and they somehow could the claim, and there's a nice paper with Prokopé Beth et al. Of last year, where they say that with the stochastic approach you can sum the leading logs to all orders in such leading logs of the scale factor.
You talked about this here.
Oh, you did? Okay. Okay, let's go to this toy model. So we have a Lagrangian. We call it lambda phi cubed. And there will be, of course, fourth order terms here. I mean, I do like a ground state, but we do not calculate those corresponding diagrams. Didn't yet. This was written like that. And then there are counter terms, plus more terms, plus counter terms. And one term you could say, a counter term linear in phi to keep the expectation value of phi fixed to zero. And then another one, important one, is the mass squared counter term, and there will be a coupling there. So the mass will be approximated by zero unless we run into infrared divergence, and then we keep it. And the mass counter term is just calculated in Minkowski space, and it is with a cutoff. That's a physical cutoff, not a co-moving scale cutoff. Lambda over mu, and mu is then a renormalization scale. So that we know beforehand, and then we want to see what happens. I remind you that this lambda has the dimension of a mass, so you could write it as a, you could write lambda is, say, a three-point coupling times a mass if you want, and then this one would be dimensionless. Now, what we want to calculate, expectation value of an observable, and that can be done, say, with the generating functional of this closed time path, depending on initial density matrix. Let me write it for once. The initial fields, I keep switching from this phi to the curly phi. They're the same in this talk, sorry. And then there's a path integral over phi, and let me go on here. Say from t initial to some time t. And we get the Lagrangians. And the sources. So the closed time path, let me make a cartoon here, goes like that. There's a plus contour, and you go back the minus contour. And the initial row then determines the boundary values, and it is it's a functional that gives quantum mechanical probabilities. It's just the matrix element of the density operator. Now, a simple and pleasant way to go about it now is to use other variables, phi 1 is the sum, and phi 2, which will be the difference of these. And then the Lagrangians that appear here, effective terms, then look like this. There are only odd terms in phi 2. So you see vertices coming out, and you see you don't see all the propagators from this case because there's only a 1-2 coupling here in the free part. And you may then wonder, how do I get the propagators? Well, you can go back to the plus-minus formalism, or I personally find it easier to go to the operator formalism and work out the operators. For instance, phi plus, say, that will be the time-ordered product, as you all know, and the phi minus, the anti-time-ordered product. So you end up with this thing that the phi one correlator can be called F, and we'll denote it by this line. And the phi 1, phi 2 correlator turns out to be the retarded Green function. So call it that object. And the 2, we give a dotted line, so it will be denoted by, say, this, and then dotted line between x and y. And the phi 2 correlator is zero. And that is not so easy. These things are not so easy to get from the path integral, except for this one, if you take the well, it needs some sort of I epsilon prescription, and, but from the operators this comes easily about. I'll give these functions in a minute in the sitter space, but this this holds very general. I mean, it holds for any non-equilibrium.
You can write it without any I epsilon from the path integral. There's no. You just take the rho is or the gr is the Poisson bracket, as you know.
Well, I'm in the quantum theory here, so it will be the okay. This deserves a formula. And then we have the retarded, it's the retarded commutator. Let me call this, yeah, this operator fields really with a hat, fine. Like that. That's all. And this one, oh yeah, deserves also a formula. Like that. So it's a symmetric thing. So they can be calculated now with operator methods, and then you start, you use them in the free theory for the free part, and then the interactions are given as de Lagrange shows there. So the interactions are then of this type. And we'll go to, okay, maybe we'll, let's first continue a bit with. Is this visible if I write this low? So, okay. To cut things short, we assume a ground state which is the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Maybe we have time later on to comment on these things. And then you can, well, there's a standard operator formalism for free fields in this Bunch-Davis vacuum. And then you get the following propagators or the retarded propagator looks like this. I make a Fourier transformation in space, but not in time. And I use conformal time, which I will in a minute describe. In the sitter space, H is the expansion rate. And we get this. We have the sign. Times the theta function, the step function, because it's a retarded one, and the f, this makes things so tricky that you have to keep the time explicit, and you can do Fourier transformation. So we take a flat background, flat space, and it looks like this. Sine and cosine are interchanged. Because it's a symmetric function in tau 1 and tau 2. Now the vertices, if I have a tau 1 here, tau 2, tau 3, is as you expect. If you go to conformal, so let's make some remarks about this, the sitter. So the scale factor is supposed to be going like that, and for the rest, spatial space is flat. And so if you say dt times a, no, dt is a of tau, I will call it now, and tau will be conformal time. Then you have that a of tau, h tau. And tau actually runs from minus infinity to zero. if you make an explicit choice for solving this differential equation, so tau is negative. That's a conventional choice here. So when tau approaches zero, A goes up. You're in the far future. So if you do that, you get these vertices. Let's say. And the 4 point and the 3 point, the other one, with three dotted lines. But this one has two lines, so one dotted line. This has two dotted lines. So I get lambda over 4. You get this a to the 4 from the volume element. This gives an a cubed, and then the additional a from this transformation gives an a to the 4, and these two delta functions.
What's the physics here that you only get this phi 2 cubed? The formula defined as a difference between phi plus and phi minus.
Yeah.
There's some physics here. Or is there?
Well, there's also phi 1 cubed, right?
Well, I take the difference.
Yeah, because you take the difference.
Of it drops out.
Right, so that drops out.
It has to be only odd terms.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you go to the classical statistical theory, there's only one of these two Hewitt vertices surviving, right? One is quantum, the other one is classical.
That's what I will mention later.
Well, perhaps, Jan, you should say why you want to calculate only this part, why only the asymmetric part. Usually that's called the decoherence part, and that vanishes on...
I want to calculate the symmetric part.
But
so what I will
write down this difference.
Now, this is a method of doing perturbation theory in a way that is simpler than working with the plus plus correlates and the minus minus correlates. Then there are always cancellations that are sort of automatic in this method. I think it's a better representation.
Where are you going? What are you trying to calculate? We can wait.
Sorry. Yeah. Let me then also write this counter term for the mass, and then I'll tell what I'm going to calculate. That's just tau 1 minus tau 2. So it's the simplest calculation that you can do in this the sitter space background, namely the 2 point corrections, the one loop, we don't go beyond that, to the equal time correlator. So you calculate this object, say, in Fourier space at equals time. That's the idea. It's called the power spectrum of this phi field, and the free part is just this F here, that one, which at equal time, it just reduces to that. I'm going into Fourier space. So you can write it as, say, F plus F1 loop plus F2 loop and so on. So it starts out like h squared over 2k cubed times 1 plus k squared tau squared. And what you see is that indeed when tau goes to zero, so after horizon exit, what is horizon exit? You have k over a is h, the physical momentum. K is the co-moving momentum. So that translates as k h tau equals h, so k tau smaller than 1 or equals 1 is horizon exit. And if you go to smaller taus for a given co-moving momentum, then you are at late times, and then this goes away and the thing becomes constant. So here you see very simply that after horizon exit, such a correlator becomes constant. Now the question is, what do the quantum, the one loop contributions here? We want to calculate it in the quantum theory and then compare it with a classical approximation. And then you can also learn about what is a good classical approximation. Why? I mean, what's the best way of doing that? Because this is like a finger oefening. What do you say? Who knows German and can translate? Finger oefening and then a little trial out to do the real thing for the CMB.
Finger Übung,
okay.
When you wrote down the original expression for f, did you miss out the factor of factors?
Yeah, I did. Sorry, h. Yeah, sorry, what have I done here? This is typical. If I'm teaching for students, then they have to be alert that I make hundreds of mistakes. And they have to... So this is an h cubed, and there should be an h over 2k cubed here.
Squared.
Cubed. H squared, yes. So. Yeah. So we are interested now in these diagrams. So it's a 1-1 correlator, right? It's this one, which is the same as that, but now it equals time. So you have a diagram. You start with 1, then you go over to 2. You use your vertex. You have this 3-point vertex. And one of them goes like that. And the other one turns into a retarded green function. And then you go like that. That's one possibility. Then you have another one, and you go completely round with F propagated, come back with an advanced propagator, the opposite of the inverse. You change the indices, you get the advanced propagator, green function. And then there is one like this. It's two retarded ones, and you use the 3-point, 3-dashed vertex, and then there is the counter term. Oops. It's again a 1-2, and these are. The external lines are supposed to be present here because that's what I'm calculating. I'm calculating the actual correlator. Okay, so what you can do is first calculate the amputated one and then calculate add the external lines. Now, okay, let me write down the for instance, this. Yeah, so you can write, let me just go quick. At the same time here, tau. And then it's like an integral for tau initial to. You have like the a to the 4. 2. Then you have the retarded propagated tau 1. Okay, then you have, say, the self-energy, the amputated one. Let's call it K tau 1, tau 2. And then you have the F. Okay. They have all that's for number A. Let's do this for A. For this, okay, I call this A, B, C and D. Tau 2, tau. Yeah. So you have these sort of unpleasant integrals here. There's a retarded green function. And this one comes on from the loop. And for instance, for this A, integral over all momenta, the retarded. And the F. So the loop momentum I call P. Oh, actually, this one I call P. This one is K. So we're interested now in the behavior after horizon exit when tau goes to zero. And then there's this thing here in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, actually, is usually sent to minus infinity. And then you have already a difficult problem. How you are going to calculate these oscillating integrals when the time goes to minus infinity? We didn't know how to handle that. So we said, let's start shortly here after horizon exit. So I replace this by a th, where th is, tau h is smaller than 1, k tau h. So we are interested in, do these correlations grow after horizon exit or not? So everything that happens until horizon exit, you can just then, well, it's just some constant term in the, as a function of tau in the final answer that we haven't calculated. But the tau dependence here will be at the upper limit is our goal.
Is there, I guess that would worry me, right? I could imagine that the self-energies and somehow pick up a lot of, have a lot of memory from all the stuff from minus infinity to your tau h,
yeah,
and get big.
Yeah, so what you can do is study that separately in perturbation theory, study the initial condition at tau h, and then it's so if you want to calculate after tau h, then you can still use, say, in perturbation theory, that would be a correction of order lambda squared. So that would be a correction on this correction. So for this calculation, you don't need it. But indeed, you might think what happens to it.
Well, better than all the Santa paper went in when he did the integral. He did from minus infinity. But the point was, for the Bunch-Davies vacuum, you can choose an I epsilon type prescription.
Yes.
That actually damps out the terms, and that's equivalent to, in fact, that's the way you pick out the Bunch-Davies vacuum out of all the other possible vacuums.
Okay.
Okay. It's a bit like if you do time evolution problems, if you evaluate the integral perfectly, all these sine and cosine, the oscillating functions, mm-hmm. if you would then send the time to minus infinity, you're also not quite sure. But if you would then do it like with 2pi resummed, then you see that there is a damping already on the right-hand side. Everything is well-defined.
Okay, 2pi resummed is,
to really describe
2pi is like a wonderful set of goal for the future. I mean, it should, I think, 2pi would be a great improvement to do such a calculation in 2pi. I agree completely with that. But first we wanted to see what happens in straightforward perturbation theory. So, then you learn something. There's also a tadpole that's then cancelled by this linear counter term that we, this one here, at least the one loop you can cancel.
It's kind of, you have quite a lot of fine equations in a digital back covert. You solve that to first order.
I'm just doing perturbation theory. I mean, all the other things come after that,
yeah,
resummation and.
You have to iterate first order.
How fast am I going? Probably pretty. Okay. Now, let's talk a bit about this diagram A. And then you can have this loop momentum and split it into small momentum and large momentum. So loop momenta that are, you take some co-moving momentum scale, which is like a cutoff, and you first look at this region and then at the region where it is bigger, and then this thing should cancel. But it makes the computation easier. And so if you do that, then it's interesting to see at these F and Gs what they become in the small momentum region. So let's first do small p, small loop momentum. Then the F becomes 2k cubed, and it is 1 plus order k squared tau, some tau squared. And the g r becomes, well, the theta function. That doesn't help, but you get an h squared over 2, 3 k cubed, say, tau to the fifth, k tau to the fifth. So what you see is that the f, indeed, as we knew already, is becomes constants and it becomes big in the, think of this k now being a loop momentum, so a p. Whereas the gr actually is of order tau cubed. This one drops out. So
these are the results. I mean, your F1 there is the contribution to the F correlator from this one loop diagram.
No. I'm just plugging this now in here.
So that's just the same perturbative F that we...
Here, this F, yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. So think of this K being a P, and this K plus P is a bit nasty because, well, you can also have the k plus p here, then you can see it's unpleasant. You have an absolute value of k minus p here in the denominator. That's why it was a bit of a struggle. Nothing of the covariant techniques work. And you run in then, if you do the calculation, you run into an infrared divergence, which from this small object here. And you can regulate it by keeping this mass non-zero here. Where is it here? So if I introduce take it as small as possible, I introduce this parameter, then what you find, then the fk, then you have to go back to your free part, and it doesn't look so simple like that. There becomes these Hankel functions, well-known Hankel functions. So, and for instance, f1, you see that it gets regulated. It becomes h squared over 2k cubed, but now times k squared tau 1 tau 2 to the power delta. And there's a similar regularization for the gr. So you get positive powers of the tau that, not only for the tau, but especially for the k squared, that now make the integrals convergent. Okay, let me not write down what you... Shall I? Yeah. No, okay. This sigma A for the small has done something like it has this... it has a theta function, again. So it's retarded. It has a lambda squared, and it has a... the number of pi's, h to the 4, and then there's this tau, it's in the denominator. And then it goes like tau 1 cubed minus tau 2 cubed over this parameter delta. That's the infrared divergence is now cured by the explicit mass. And then there will be other terms. Okay, let's now go to the large momenta. Oh, yeah, there was an approximation made here.
Can you say something about this infrared divergence, what the physics is behind? You cured it now by putting it in mass.
I can come back to it later, but I can now ask the question. So I think that if I would... this is a big subject that that people have said different things about. If I would... diagonalize. I have a free field, say, on because I'm talking about free field propagators here. That's where it came from. I have a free field on a de Sitter background. If I just diagonalize the Hamiltonian at one given time, and then look at some time later, there's no infrared divergence. But if this given time is sent to minus infinity, then this initial state goes over to the Bunch-Davis state, and then apparently I will at the end. Like this interpretation, I've been creating particles that cause large occupation numbers that cause this 1 over k squared enhancement here. So that the 1 over k becomes a 1 over k cubed. I think that is the physics behind it.
So you say with resummation it wouldn't be cured and become finite?
No, it's the initial state that has it already in it. And in Bunch-Davis has this.
The statement is the Bunch-Davis state does not exist for a massless minimally coupled field in the Sitter space. The propagator is divergent. The propagator itself is divergent.
Also beyond perturbation theory.
Well, this is a free theory.
It's free.
In the free theory, it's divergent. So you expand around that place, you're going to get divergence.
The same state when you could do near second order phase transition. Just plug in the propagator of a master theory and you get all infrared divergences, and then you calculate using your summation and you see everything is finite and you can.
And you have to decide how to handle it. But the statement, the initial statement is that the state you're expanding around is really not the right state.
In doing this approximation, I choose delta not too small. I mean, the latest time not too small, this will come back. When tau goes to zero, that's the any of these taus now in the final answer, then you get log tau increments, which is like log of the scale factor, because we have this relation. And so we took that approximation. Now, let's go to large momenta. Now, large momenta, there you can do some power counting. But let me say you run into some interesting problem here. Let delta be the time difference between tau 1 and tau 2 in this self-energy here. Then, and as I said, it's a retarded self-energy. Then you have something like appearing like delta, the theta step function over that comes in. But it comes in together with a cosine of two, the cutoff lambda that I impose. We just use a sharp momentum cutoff for simplicity, designed in Minkowski space, but now put in here. And then there's also the scale factor at some tau, the smallest taus times delta, like that. So what you see then now, that this doesn't exist. You cannot make this into a, it's one-sided. You can not regulate as a principal value. An I epsilon is nowhere to be seen. But it regulates itself, but then when delta goes to zero, it's regulated. But when lambda is very big, the cutoff here near the origin becomes narrower and narrower. So you wonder what is going to be. And actually, you can, with test functions, say that in the distributional sense, you can regulate it with some eta going to plus zero. And then you say, well, let this delta be bigger than zero, and then it would be finite. But then there are corrections, which is a delta function situated at the origin times the Euler constant. And then there's a log of 2 lambda eta. So when eta goes to zero, if you integrate this with something, the divergence here is cancelled by this log term. You get the log divergence that's cancelled, and then say tau 1 or so is coming out. Yeah. So plus terms vanishing when lambda goes to zero. This is I don't know if it's order lambda minus 1 or others. Anyway, it vanishes when lambda goes to 0. So here you see a local divergence, a log lambda divergence with a locality in it. And that is precisely cancelled by this mass counter term. So here we found our nice divergence in the ultraviolet cutoff, which is cancelled by the mass counter term. Now, let me say how much time have we got left? Yeah, okay. So I want to speed up a bit. Say something about diagram B and C. This one has a linear divergence in this ultraviolet cutoff, and this also, and they cancel. So that's nice. And then, everything comes out nice and finite and so on. So let me give then the answer for this one loop. So you plug.
Are there logs hiding under those linear divergences?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. No. I could give you some detail, but I don't think there are. If so, then we missed it. I mean, but I didn't see it. Yeah. So you get, say, lambda squared over lots of pi's in the denominator, k cubed. And then you get something like 1 over 9 delta plus lots of terms with zeta functions, pi's. And then you get a log of, say, minus k tau h. So that depends on our lower limit. So this comes out after we do these integrals. They're sort of unpleasant. Well, you get standard functions, but still, it's just. Then you get the 2 over delta plus other terms, and then you get the log mu, the renormalization scale. And you get, there's an 1/8 log minus k tau h again, but this is then multiplied by log tau over tau h. And that's the first log a growing term. Log tau is minus log a up to some scale. Then there will be another term like that, 2 over delta plus other stuff. And then there's a log squared, tau over tau h, and there's actually also a log cubed. Plus terms that are subdominant. So it's quite interesting. There's a log cubed of the scale factor growing in this correlator after horizon exit. But because of this condition here that we took, I mean, it can, of course, be relaxed in a more complicated calculation. This log squared one with the 2 over delta is supposed to be bigger than that one, or possibly of the same order. Okay, now that was that. Now the classical. Because what can be, it looks a bit complicated. How can we now devise the classical approximation? And what would be a good classical approximation? Well, first we have to define it as usual. So you replace the operator field by a classical field, the operator density operator by a classical one, which is a function of the initial phis and pi's. And this then is a solution of the classical field equations, which look like this. With certain initial conditions, the phi and the phi dot, and given the initial condition, you integrate this, and then you
d tau squared the first one.
Thanks. So this gets replaced by the classical O, which is then an integration over the initial phi and pi. The rho, and then your observable, which is then a function of, say, time, but also of the initial conditions. Now, how to do that? In perturbation theory again, and then we can compare. So you write phi as a, say, the order lambda zero, first order, second order, and so on. And how can you get that? Lambda squared. For instance, from the integral equation. If you rewrite this differential equation as an integral equation where the initial conditions are in it. the a to the 4 goes with the volume, the retarded green function, and then you have the phi y squared from the interaction here. Yeah, okay. Now this GR is the green function of this free part, and it's exactly the same as the GR I was talking about. It's like also in Minkowski space, typically the free case, that finite temperature fields here, the GRs, they're like the retarded commutators, they are like the free ones. I mean, they are not modified, how shall I say? Let me not say anything, otherwise I'll say something wrong. So you can iterate this equation now, and then you get a sum of three graphs. So phi is then, say, something like that. Now comes the green function. That, these two. Let me give three diagrams here. Give an infinite sum of three graphs, as is well known. This is the green function again, and then here. So this little thing with, phi zero, then this is a GR, phi zero, and so on. And this phi zero is the free field solution of that. And now you want to do this ensemble average over the initial state. So if you do that, you have something like, so you have phi zero, phi zero. That is like taking the average over this phi zero. This we can choose. Let's call it F classical. Call this point x and y. It's F. Having done that, you can then calculate the classical correlator by saying that these two crosses gets tied together into an F correlator. And for instance, this one would give that plus. Now I have added one phi here, so you have to think in your mind the product of these two. But for this one, which is already order lambda, I take that one, but that would give zero, because then I have a phi zero cubed here. But here, I have a correction, so I am taking the average, so imagine that you put another cross here, and then the crosses can do this here, give an F and an F there, or these two, so you get these diagrams. You get, for instance, this one, this tadpole, and you get also this one. And so on. So, as Jürgen said already, in the classical theory, you get similar diagrams. You get exactly the same diagrams, the same combinatorics, except that this vertex doesn't occur in the classical theory. You only have this vertex, a GR, and two phis, and the phis give this solid line. Tadpole gets cancelled again, so we are interested in these type of diagrams. Now, so now we can talk about the classical diagrams. Now, you might think there are certain choices here. This F, I just wiped it out, but you can, for instance, it seems like a good choice to take it equal to the F of the first one, this one. For a quantum theory, then we are as close as possible. And this vertex here, for instance, has a quarter, so it is already some down compared to that. Anyhow, that's one possibility. Another way of reasoning is that you say, well, I can take the dominant part. For instance, I can just take this first term here in my classical approximation. Then, and you see this already happening also in the quantum theory, that is really, this one gets big for small k, and that's why why you get this enhancement. But the retarded green function, which I didn't show, so the remember the GR goes like h squared over 3 times tau 1 cubed minus tau 2 cubed. So it's small because the taus typically are small because we are looking in the small tau regime. So it doesn't blow up at all. So the in the quantum theory also, the minimum number of GRs in diagrams gives you the biggest contribution. So this has two GRs, so this will be subdominant to that one that will only have one or here and things like that too. That's the reason. So you can say that leaving out these diagrams then in the quantum theory will give you the classical approximation. That's one thing we know, but we also know that in the large tau regime and for the small k regime, you will indeed pick up also the most important contribution in the classical from the quantum theory. Now, there's one problem, because if I leave out this diagram here, if I take the exact f that I would like to take, exact free part, then there will be an ultraviolet divergence. As I said, this one diverges linearly, but this cancels it. But if I throw away this diagram, then I'm left with a linear divergence. So with that choice of initial conditions here, we would have to take a cutoff finite. Now, we sort of convinced ourselves by looking at the errors that that is actually more accurate than keeping only the dominant infrared part here, so than keeping only this part. So in this way, you can say something about the classical approximation, and you you learn about it. How much time have I got left now? Cool. Little. So let me now just make some remarks with the stochastic approach. In stochastic approach, what people have done, coming from Starobinsky and I think most best presented and as a leading log approximation by Woodard et al., you just keep the leading terms here. You keep the leading term in F, you keep the leading term in G, but you do a few other things. In the stochastic approach, people usually didn't take this mass as a regulator, but they took the, they said K has to be bigger than the Hubble scale. It's an infrared cutoff there. K over A, actually, the physical momentum. So that's a sort of physical wavelength that then grows. So after some time, you really have a big volume, but you start with a patch of order of the Hubble scale. And then because the ultraviolet divergences are not so severe, I suppose, with this choice, or they are absent, I think they're actually absent with this leading choice here and in the F, keeping only the one here. They also have an upper sort of ultraviolet scale cutoff, like, it says it, shall it, H time. Yeah. An upper limit. Let me check if I say this correctly.
That's a little confusing.
What?
That's a little confusing. I thought the stochastic approximation was going to be valid for large wavelengths, which is small. Better check the signs of those inequalities.
Yeah, I think it's correct. Like,
so that's a condition for what?
I got it wrong. Sorry. It's like this.
K is a co-moving wave.
Yeah, K is co-moving. K is co-moving, that's why the patch grows. Otherwise it wouldn't have grown.
This is a condition for what?
The case you allow in the loop integrals, all case you allow anywhere.
In order to get what?
In order to get an approximation that is then you find that these this correlator can be written as in terms of Langevin noise in a certain way, and then you have a basically you have an infrared approximation which gives the biggest logs and log squared. So you make then a leading log approximation, except this 1 over delta is essentially replaced by a log h, and which will then be made dimensionless in the various ways.
Yeah, so the k, the right hand of that inequality on the stack. So if I bring the a to the middle, it says that k over a, which is the physical wavelength, physical wave number, has to be less than h, or the physical wavelength is greater than the horizon. Right. That makes sense. Now, I don't understand the other half of the inequality. That's why do you demand that k is greater than h?
Otherwise, you run into infrared divergences.
Oh, that's the regulator. If you put the mass there.
This infrared cutoff, we did with a mass 1 over delta, but it turns out in a log h, and we checked it, that if we redo the calculation with this regime, then we get the same answer as the stochastic approach. So in that way, the stochastic can be explained. Now, the last thing I would like to mention is this analogy with finite temperature field theory, and that is that.
Maybe before you go on, in terms of the actual physics of this problem, so what's the bottom line? So these modes, after they go outside the horizon, fluctuations cause them to continue to grow logarithmically, but in some fashion that has nasty sensitivity to how you handled infrared issues?
Yeah. Yeah. Not so nasty, but there will be a... The coefficient depends. The coefficient of the growing log with the scale factor depends on how you handle the infrared. Yeah.
It can be arbitrarily large or small.
Okay, so then comes in the 2pi or the resummation. You would think that after some time, even if you start mass or somehow, you generate an effective mass and it cuts off. And this cutting off effect hasn't been, you don't find it in perturbation theory, and 2pi would be a good start to try, but maybe you can analyze it also otherwise. That's what we think. I mean, I like a mass better than this sort of intuition on an initial patch that grows. How big should we choose the patch? Perhaps not bigger than the horizon scale, but I mean, this is the hand waving of the inflationary philosophy.
So what physics depends on these infrared issues, this overall scale, this overall factor that would change dramatically if you change different masses? Is it a big issue?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, the question is, what is it you want to try to get out? Are we talking about just studying the classical approximation as a toy model? Are we talking about making predictions for inflation?
No, this is just a start. I mean, this is just one calculation. A lot has to be done for the actual CMB, when it's more complicated, you have derivative couplings, and so you can say something about it. But the actual calculation has partly been done by Sloth, but not, I mean, it's basically a little bit at the beginning, I think, of refinement. The corrections are probably very small that we're talking about here. But it's also a matter of principle.
I mean, in what sense are they small? Because if you put a mass regulator, you get 1 over m squared divergences. So
it's
very unclear what that means.
Yeah.
And your linear divergence in the UV.
With a cutoff, that's a bit bigger than the Hubble scale, 3 times or so, we found numerically that the classical approximation is very accurate. So the way we, this F correlator, can be written as 1 over a tau 1, a tau 2, times nk plus nk plus a half, I call it nk bar, times the cosine, say, k tau 1 minus, well, maybe I shouldn't. Let's say it at equal time, tau 1 equals tau 2. This is what you get times 1 over k divided by k. I mean, it can be expressed in terms of particle numbers, which are of the most simple-minded particle. You take your system, you do a canonical quantization on this background, you have then, it's only a harmonic set of harmonic oscillators with the mass, the mass is the scale factor squared, and the frequency is, say, k squared plus a squared m squared. So a time-dependent mass and a time-dependent frequency, but that doesn't let you, that doesn't forbid you to introduce creation annihilation operators. And with, in such a way, then you'll find that the a dagger a, just straightforward canonical oscillator, quantization and so on, is what I call nk, and that is 1 over 4 k squared tau squared. So when tau goes to 0, you get large occupation numbers, and you also have an a correlator. Say this is at k minus k, same here. And if I take the real part, that will be, I call n bar of k. And then the F correlator can then be just expressed, and also the retarded Green function, in terms of such occupation numbers. And so, and then you see what I said maybe at the meeting. You can either keep the half or only take the bigger ones. And you see, if you take the big, if you only keep the large particle numbers, then you have this 1 over k squared, and then you might do a job that doesn't suffer so from infrared divergences. If you keep the half, you may get more accuracy. That's what we did here in this language. But then you have to put a cutoff on the whole thing. And as we know also in the other classical approximations in Minkowski space. But this is all I wanted to say. Emil doesn't like this. I should also say he doesn't like these. But I would say this is at least the most simple thing you can do. And it gives the F correlators and are simply expressible in terms of these time. They're time dependent. So if I have two different times, they will have different times, you know, because I have a time dependent background. But still, they are, I think it is a nice interpretation. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
So, if you would do this perturbative calculation and make it self-consistent, call it 2pi, you also need to put in an initial condition, if you like, this tau to minus infinity. What would you choose as an initial condition? If you take this Bunch-Davis vacuum, you get the same infrared divergences, isn't it? You'd put in by hand these divergences, as far as I understand. So what initial condition would you take if you want to go beyond perturbation theory, say, doing something self-consistent?
You can do various things. I think Bunch-Davis is quite a good, reasonable choice, and I think the infrared divergence will cure itself probably by the generation of an effective mass. That's what I really think.
So. Even keeping this initial condition fixed, which is just...
Yeah. Another possibility is that you take these A of k as a function of tau and define a vacuum as a function of tau, which is not Bunch-Davis. You start at some tau initial, and then everything is finite. Only when tau goes to zero things blow up, but tau, you don't let it go all the way to zero, you just, you know, you let it grow and see what happens. Then everything is fine. Then you can study the limit of this going to minus infinity. See what, I mean, then it's more controlled. Or you just put an infrared cutoff, why not? Take some box and see what happens when you remove the box. Yes.
Is this too naive? I mean, in ordinary quantum field theory, I mean, if you have an infrared divergence, there's something physical. That's all you have to think about it. And what the explanation there is that you produce particles, soft particles, yes, to cure the infrared singularity. And of course, this is now in the Sitka background with you have conformal time, and so it's different, yes, but
I interpret it as
similarity.
I think you know, the if you start with an initial state at some time, there's no problem. It's only when you think of inflation having going on for an infinite number of times. So you send the initial state to minus infinity, then it has had chance to create particles, those ones, for an infinite amount of time. And then, yeah, you do find infinite particle numbers when k becomes zero.
So ask me that question.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I mean, as we were saying here, there are kind of two strains of thought and tracks in the literature. One is very careful and formal and taking very seriously this infrared divergence, in which case I think the established point of view is you don't start with a bunch of Davy states, it's just a bad state. So you have to do essentially a Bobrov transformation to another state, which goes by the name of Allen Fallaci, because that was discussed 20 years ago. By Bruce Allen. And that's, I think, the standard GR-based lore. Then, of course, then there's a second strain where people do all kinds of things in stochastic, in trying to make some observational consequence for CMB, and they typically don't worry about this and say, anyway, I don't care about formal divergences in an eternal de Sitter space, I'll just start with some state and not worry about it. But it means that there is a sensitivity to those initial conditions, which may or may not have physical consequences, depending on what you're trying to do.
But when you say this Bogoliubov transformation, then there is no infrared divergence.
That's right. If you start with a different state.
In flat space, it would just take into account the tadpole diagram.
That's right. So someone
the mass
said,
by fluctuation.
Someone said Bloch-Nortzi. No, it's not to take. No, it's in the free theory.
In the free theory,
you should start with a propagator that does not have infrared divergences. You would think.
Okay. Yeah. That. Sorry. Yeah.
Right.
That is true, and I must say that this is I agree. This is too naive. As soon as you go away from Tauin, this state has problems that. We'll have already ultraviolet problem. I mean, then you have a sort of switched on stuff infinitely fast.
What makes this all very naughty
then you get ultraviolet.
Is that modes, of course, that start out ultraviolet get inflated exponentially to modes that become infrared. So if you're not careful, you can get all mixed up between what's an ultraviolet effect and what's an infrared effect.
In particular, you just count what is dominant in the infrared. Like we've also seen from Tomislav talk, and then you see that it's completely dependent on the details how you treat the infrared.
Yeah. Or the ultraviolet. If you threw away some terms, and then the ultraviolet behavior is screwed up, you can get a different answer in the infrared. So this does require some care.
That latter aspect. I mean, in the Bunch Davies, at least.
So a few years ago, some of the Stringy folks were talking a lot about trans-Planckian problem, which is just a fancy way of saying just this, that modes which start out, even in principle, at wavelengths shorter than the Planck scale, eventually become inflated, to cosmological scales, if you wait enough. So could it be that some Planck scale physics or Stringy physics actually is visible in the CMB? So now that's a real live question of how you treat the ultraviolet. And we wrote several papers on what we think the right answer is with an effective field theory approach, in which you can always wait a few orders of magnitude after the Planck time so that you believe that you can write down an effective theory. And within the effective theory, you have some restriction on what the initial states can be. They should not have new ultraviolet divergences. If you take that point of view, then all of this is controlled and you can then make firm predictions. But of course, you can take other points of view. So it's quite a long discussion here, many things that one could say, but.
If you have something which is trans-Planckian, I mean, if you boost it, you can make it sub-Planckian. I mean, why should there be special treatment?
Now the point is, I mean, suppose you look on the CMB sky today, right? And you've got certain scales that you like. Then red shift them back, you know, blue shift them back to sort of near the beginning of inflation. Those will be transfinite scales.
Or, yeah, sure.
Right. And so the question is, how do you you don't know what the physics is.
I can go to a frame where it's less than Planck.
But I'm measuring it in the frame of the, you know, if I've done an FRW foliation, right, I'm already sort of, I'm in a preferred coordinate system. I'm being the Hubble expanding observer. That's the frame I'm using to do my calculation.
But there's a preferred frame, right, in which inflation takes place, in which the CMB is at rest.
Right. I mean, when people do the observations, they subtract out the dipole of our motion, and then they're looking at the at-rest fluctuation.
May I also add, so if someone has, for instance, after Jan's talk, wants to add a reference to something that is linked to this question, on the wiki space, everybody can just add comments or links. Sometimes it helps to keep the discussion going. There was a lot of use of that in the beginning of the program, then it died out a bit. So I just want to remind people, because I did it, we did it a lot in the beginning of the program, and now it's useful.
Now there's a big literature on these kinds of subjects.
Yeah, don't put everything.
But I can put a few references.
Okay, I guess we should thank Jan, but before people leave, a few announcements.